session number 16355, reel 4.
Mr. Rems, reel 4.
He was quite a rosy-cheeked, rotund man, and quite healthy and jovial, until I answered that question, and then he visibly changed. He somehow seemed to shrink in his seat. His face was drained of colour, and it was I could almost see him trembling, as though he'd suddenly been struck by a blow. It seemed as though at that time he'd suddenly realised what the effect of his actions had been. When he launched the torpedoes, all he'd done was to manipulate a little bit of machinery. Then he was told afterwards, oh yes, we've done what we're supposed to do. But later on, when he was confronted, 50 years after, by the effect of what he had done, then it really hit home at him. And, well, it was a physical shock, as well as a mental and emotional shock. We did get over that situation, and, well, instead of being traditional enemies, we eventually became like long-lost brothers.
And did you actually join their association?
We actually joined their association, yes, we were invited to join them. We had many holidays across there, met many of the men who had served in U-73, and although the U-73 crew fluctuated quite a lot, there are 5 members still alive who were actually on that particular voyage, Hines of course being one of them.
Now, you had got so far as having returned to the UK.
Yes.
With the Argus again.
Yes, we came home after the sinking of the Eagle, and we were transferred from the depot at Leon Solent to HMS Kestrel, which was a maintenance and care base at Worthy Down. By this time, my wife was living at Leon Solent, at Leamington Spa. The first day of 1943, things were looking quite rosy after our experience with the Eagle late in the August of 42, and I was literally struck down. By literally, I mean physically struck down. I was working on a communications aircraft, and it was a case of bad weather again, having to prime the cylinders of the engine by hand pushing the airplane propeller in a circular direction. The switches were off, of course, but the fuel supply was laid on, so that as the engine was working, fuel vapour was being sucked into the cylinders. In theory, nothing should have happened until I got back into the cockpit of that plane, switched the electrical gear on, and started the engine. In practice, it didn't work that way. In practice, the compression was such, and the weather conditions so freak, that while I was still pushing that aeroplane propeller around, the engine started. The first blade hit me and the forearm, well, it was the elbow actually, and shattered my elbow completely. The second blade came round, I'd been dragged slightly into the path of the blades, and hit me on the femur, shattered my leg. The third blade came round, and mercifully, the full length of the blade caught me the full length of my spine, and just lifted me and tossed me about 40 feet away. In retrospect, I was lucky. I say in retrospect because even though I was put out of action for several months. I did eventually recover to some degree in one piece. Immediately after I had been struck on the field, two similar incidents occurred. The first one, the poor chap who was hit, he'd done exactly the same thing as I had. His forearm was chopped through completely, and he just lost his forearm. The second chap, he wasn't quite so viciously mutilated at the time, but he was also hit on the arm, and his arm was mutilated to such a degree that it had to be amputated. Consequently, when I got over my shock and found myself in the hospital with both my arms, my legs and my feet still attached, even though I was like a mummy, I was in plaster of Paris from underneath my armpits, the full torso down my right leg and my right arm across my chest. I thought, well, maybe I'm going to go the same way, maybe I'm going to lose some bits and pieces. Well, the worst thing that happened was the fact that I complained about pain in my foot, my right foot. And 6 weeks after I'd started to complain, they decided to investigate because they'd said it was possibly swelling in the tissue that had caused pain, and when the swelling goes down, you'd lose the pain. Well, they'd cut a small hole in the plaster of Paris and the point of my heel where I'd been complaining most. And as the saw went into the plaster, so liquid began to seep out. When they eventually did get in far enough to see what had gone on, my heel had completely disappeared. All that was left was the shiny bone sticking through, nice and white and greasy. The bone had completely rotted over, the flesh had completely rotted away. But eventually, the bones healed up. I was able to get rid of the plaster. The foot had to have some attention. And gradually, the flesh began to build back around the heel bone. There was no amputation as such. But at the back of the heel, they developed what is known as a plaster sore. That is a huge callus, and it developed in the same way as a horse's hoof. The only way I could be made comfortable was for me to put my foot on a chair and use a carpenter's rasp to rasp it down. This was rather irritating to anybody who happened to be standing by and watching it. They didn't like it. I didn't like it either at the time. But gradually I got used to it. The thing was, it used to wear my socks out like mad. Anyway, while I was in Kestrel, we had this experience. We got over it. I was detailed off for a draft again, and due to the fact that I was a little bit debilitated, I got my jabs and I got vaccine fever, so I missed that draft. Fortunately for me, because that draft never arrived at its destination, it was intercepted on the high seas, and I'm afraid my wife got one of those awful certificates to say that your husband is missing. It was a lack of communication somehow, a slip up, a hiccup, but it was a chap whose name was very similar to mine, a chap whose name was Eames rather than Ames, and he was included in the draft in my stead. So that was another reason why Kestrel stuck in my mind. Things were beginning to get a little bit easier after that time, and they decided that I was not fit for sea duty as such, but my knowledge and expertise was required elsewhere. And suddenly I found myself drafted to one of the ocean-going liners, the Cunarda, the Queen Mary, as a passenger to go to America. We went across on the Queen Mary and we were billeted inside the drained swimming pool. It had flip type bunk beds on the side of the swimming pool, and mine was the third bunk up out of four. There were bunks in the middle, but I was on one of the side bunks. We eventually got to New York, Pier 90, discharged, temporarily unloaded into a dormitory, which was the area between the two docks, the two quays, and the dormitory housed 7,000 men on one floor. Oh, this terrified me. I'd never seen so many men in one place at one time. There was no sleeping accommodation as such. One or two of them had managed to get bunks from various places, but the fact that we was Navy and carrying our own hammocks, that was it. So we spread our hammocks down on the deck and bundled in best way we could. I was glad to get out of that place. Temperature at that time was well down below freezing. But being Americans, they had central heating, and their central heating was sky high. And the fact that there were so many people in one place, it was like a greenhouse. 24 hours later, we were drafted out of there onto a train. It also was central heated, was the train. And although the temperature was well down below zero outside, blizzards all the way, it was up to 80 degrees in the train. We all felt mafted. We eventually clued up at a place called Lewiston. Lewiston, in the state of Maine, had at that time, I think it was 30 degrees of frost. There was a Fleet Air Arm, well, it wasn't a Fleet Air Arm station, it was a US Navy station there. We were put into there and we were to form a new squadron. The new squadron was to be formed with American aircraft, the TBF Avenger and the Corsair. The TBF was a torpedo bomber fighter, and the Corsair was the dive bomber, the gull wing dive bomber. These were also very big aircraft. TBF carried 3-man crew, the Corsair 2-man crew. Well, we couldn't understand their way of working, and of course the Fleet Air Arm, it's more or less segregated itself. And well, the Avenger was a right, well, I was going to use a legitimate word, but I don't know whether that's typical for these, a right B to work on. And to get to the generator that was fitted to the rear cover of the Avenger engine, you had to climb through a small hatchway, which was just big enough to get half your head through on one hand. And the generator was fitted with a ring of 16 nuts on studs, which you could not see, they were concealed. It was a right pig's orphan to get to. We learned that the Americans, when they had any trouble with that particular section of their machine, they just unship the machine completely and put a new machine in, a new engine in. They couldn't be bothered with doing small repairs like that. But of course, being British and having to work with limited tools, it was a case of, well, you're an air mechanic, engine branch, you work on every part of the engine. You're not like the Americans, being an air mechanic, you work on airplane propellers. You're an air mechanic, you work on airplane carburetors. You're an air mechanic, you work on airplane ignition. They had their airplanes were split up into about 16 different, the engines were split up into about 16 different sections, and there were about 16 different men working on one machine, where we just had the one. And when we introduced them to crew foot spanners, well, to them, it was like reinventing the wheel. They'd never seen a crow foot spanner. The economy of waste out there was something fantastic. They said they used to unship and refit new engines just for the slightest fault.
So this was a US Navy squadron?
US Navy squadron, yes.
Why were fleet aeromen
a US Navy station. But we were going across there to be fitted up with US aircraft because we were due to go out into the Pacific.
So the squadron was to be fleet aeromen?
Fleet aeromen squadron, yeah. A thing like the economy of waste, for instance, if we took a small cotton bud and dipped it in petrol to move a stain, an oil stain from your clothing, that was frowned on. But if you took a 4-gallon drum of carbon tetrachloride, dipped a wad of cotton waste in it just to move that same oil smudge, that was acceptable. The queer people are the Yanks. Anyway, one day there were some parcels arrived, some packages arrived, and they were directed to the Fleet Air Arm branch. And when we opened them up, there were sufficient bits and pieces in it to form a Spitfire. So, oh, back at home, we really enjoyed putting this Spitfire together. It was like putting a little Meccano together again. We set to with gusto, and as soon as it was completed, of course, the CO of our Fleet Air Arm squadron said, "That's mine. Nobody else touches that. That's mine." Well, the Yanks had seen this thing built. What is it? What's this little toy that they've got here? Can't understand them using things like this. We said, "It's a Spitfire." Oh, well, what do you use them for? Well, you'll find out. Well, when it was completed, we did the test run in the hangar. The CO brought it out onto the tarmac. Half a dozen mechanics draped them across the wings. Four mechanics drove them across the tailplanes. He ran it up to full boost, gave the signal, chucks away, mechanics away. He took off, shortest run possible, stood it on its tail, and shot up vertical, just like a rocket going up. The Yanks looked round and said, "Well, is that it then?" Next minute, less than a minute, everybody was flat down on their faces. The CO had gone straight up, turned round, and he come down 0 feet across the tarmac, shooting everybody up. The fun of it was, the armourers had loaded the machine guns with blank ammunition. And as he came across, he opened up with his 8 machine guns, with blank ammunition. Well, the Yanks were all wearing yellow trousers by the time they'd finished. When he came down, he had to report to the station CO, who really tore him off a strip. And apparently, it was said that our squadron CO just stood there and took it all in, never saying a word, until right at the end, when he just casually said, "It's about time your chaps learn to expect the unexpected." And with that, walked out. Got back to his machine, which had been serviced by then, re-oiled up, took off again, did a similar kind of thing, came back at 0 feet, and instead of using his machine guns, he'd noticed that there was a hangar at the far end which was vacant, and he flew right through the hangar, then went up and did a aerobatic display. There were no more recriminations after that. The station CO apparently gave him best. I met a family across there, the Woodwards, and they invited me into their home. That was quite a novel arrangement, living high on the hog after being on a restricted diet. Oh, going back to the Queen Mary, of course, there's one thing there that I must impress on you. We had been living on a restricted diet across here, and when they got onto the Mary, the food that was given to us was so much that within 12 hours, all our draft were on charge for wasting food. We just could not eat the food that was given to us because there was so much. And it turned out that the American caterers who were catering the Queen Mary, in their small print, they'd worked in what is known nowadays as a scam. The Queen Mary would be provisioned in America, come across and go back. But one company would reprovision the ship, and it would be wholly provisioned. Whatever stores was left regard to foodstuffs, when it got back to America, were taken out of the ship and destroyed. This is a time when there was down to 1 ounce of cheese, you know, in England with the rations. They were literally destroying foodstuff, whether it was dried foods or canned foods or anything else. And then the ship again was reprovisioned, the whole lot. So the American caterers were really making a bomb out of that. Anyway, as I say, we went to the Woodwards, and it was a Saturday night treat for us to go out in the evening to the local beach and dig clams, or to get crayfish, take them back and boil them, and their Saturday evening supper was usually either, you know, these clams or their crayfish with brown bread, butter and whiskey. It was enough to make anybody sleep well. It was a supper like that. Mr. Woodward asked me if I had got my car with me. I said, no, I'm sorry, I wasn't allowed to bring one. Oh, I said, here's a bunch of keys, do you take the Willis while you're here and use that. The petrol station around the corner, go and get your coupons there. Well, he was pleased for me to do that, because as a visitor for that little Willis, I was able to get enough petrol vouchers for a weekend to keep him going for 2 months. He was really chuffed, he liked the idea, because their petrol scheme was altogether different to what ours was. Anyway, Mrs. Woodward asked me, is there anything you miss while they're across here? I said, yes, there is. Yorkshire curd cheesecake and tomatoes, fresh tomatoes. Oh, I said, plenty of tomatoes here. I said, yes, but the tomatoes that you've got here are not like tomatoes we grow at home. Well, she said, ask your wife for a recipe and see if she can send us some tomato seed. She did, though. Well, as soon as she saw that the curd for making the Yorkshire cheesecakes was started off by using Epsom salts. No, none of that. Anyway, we'll try these tomato seeds. Well, the tomato seeds came like that. They really went into business with them. They got more tomatoes out of that packet of seeds than they could do with. They were selling them, giving them away, even supplying the local traders with them. Because the moneymaker tomatoes that we were growing, they were smaller, sweeter, and much better flavour than the big American tomatoes. And the local shopkeepers eventually came to Mr. Woodward and said, please, don't give any more of these away. We can't sell our tomatoes. Anyway, all the good things must come to an end, and I did something very, very stupid. I qualified as a petty officer. Now, that was stupid inasmuch as the squadron, although it was forming up, did not have capacity for an extra petty officer. So they had to find me a new billet, and that new billet was back here in Europe. Because of my exalted status, I came back on the Cunarda again, but it wasn't the Mary, it was the Elizabeth. And this time, instead of being in the swimming pool, I was billeted in a two-berth cabin with six of us in it. We still had bunk beds, flip-type beds, billeted, hinged to the walls of the cabins. When I got back into England, I was told, You're going back to Malta. Oh, sir, thank you very much. We came back to Malta and things were a little bit easier by that time, and I was billeted and sent to Califrana.
Which year have we reached now?
That's 43. End of 43. I went to Califrana. Now, Califrana was a seaplane base originally, and there was no actual landing strip for aircraft. It was just a ramp where boat hull and float planes were dragged up from the sea. But there was a roadway that went from Califrana to Halfar. Now, that roadway had been widened so that aircraft could be towed from Califrana, which was the workshops, to Halfar. And although Halfar was the RAF base, there was quite a lot of activity going on there. There wasn't so many of the bombing raids as such. We had quite a lot of business to do at Califrana with the workshops. Eventually, my lords of the Admiralty decided that Califrana was not big enough for us to do what they wanted to do, and they decided that they would up stakes from there and take over part of the airfield at Halfar. So all the stuff that we collected at Halfar, which was quite considerable, in as much as we've been scrounging everything that we possibly could, including aeroplane trips to North Africa, aeroplane trips to Sicily for getting spares, all had to be destroyed. It wasn't necessary. It was surplus to requirements. One of the trips we did to North Africa, we went to Bolida. It was an airstrip that the French had been using. It was going to be evacuated, and we were told if there was anything we want, get in there, grab it and get out. We took a couple of Wellingtons across, loaded everything that we could, and the thing at the time was we were short of Wellington wheels, tyres and tubes. We opened the bomb bays of the Wellingtons, manoeuvred, manhandled these wheels complete inside the bomb bays, hoisted them up with jacks, lashed them inside the aircraft best way we could with anything that we could lay our hands on, metal cables, ropes, or anything we could, and eventually took off with the bomb bay open and the wheels dangling outside. Well, by the time we got back to Malta, the cables had stretched, and the pilot was in a little bit of doubt as to whether to land or keep on circling forever. He didn't know which wheel was going to touch first. Luckily, when we did land, there was 3 inches clearance between the runway and the cargo that we was carrying. The lashings had dropped to such a degree. He said he wouldn't do that again. The next time we went out on a trip like that, we went to Sicily. And as you know, there's the extinct volcano at Etna there. But of course, being a volcano shape, it had rather disturbing air currents around it. And the younger pilots, they used to enjoy flying in that area, much to the annoyance of us irks in the back. They just used to put one wingtip round and circle around it, and the wings of the